Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and we're joined today by Dr. Kelly Beers, Medical Director of Albany Medical Center's Glomerular Disease Center, an interdisciplinary center focused on providing the most up-to-date treatment for people who have been diagnosed with specific kidney diseases, and we will get into that list soon. She also cares for patients with general kidney conditions, including chronic kidney disease, acute kidney injury, and hypertension. Board certified in internal medicine and nephrology, Dr. Beers has advanced training in glomerular disease. She completed a fellowship in nephrology at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City and a residency in internal med at Stony Brook School of Medicine. You have a question? Give us a shout. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Kelly Beers, you're here for your annual visit. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you? You have gotten so good at saying glomerular.
Remember how horrible it was back
in
the
really
day?
I'm really proud.
Yeah, thank you very much. I only practice it once a year. How are things at the Glomerular Disease Center, I must say?
They're good. Yeah, things are going well. It's a really exciting time to be a nephrologist, and especially one that specializes in glomerular disease, because there's a ton of new drugs on the market, actually. So there's been an explosion of research into particular diseases, the pathophysiology, and what's causing them. And there's been all of these new drugs in development. So we have a lot of really exciting new treatments that we're able to offer to our patients at the GN Center at Albany Med, and there's more things in the pipeline, and we've made some great contacts with industry, and we're hoping to be able to offer clinical trials very soon to our patients with rare diseases.
Interesting about the clinical trials. Now, you find out sort of, you get word that, oh, there's this thing coming down the pike, but we can't do anything with it yet. How do you vet those? There must be tons of things coming down that never see a clinical trial in your, you know, at Albany Med.
Yeah, so Albany Med has been doing clinical trials for a very, very long time, and there's an excellent staff that just does that, who are the experts in what are the clinical trials that are good that we should be participating in. We have research coordinators who specifically just work on clinical trials and are experts just in that area specifically. As far as what clinical trials we're interested in doing, you know, I meet with the drug companies that are doing the clinical trials and sort of look at what their proposed drug is compared to what's on the market. What's the placebo? Do I think this is something that could benefit our patients or not? To kind of determine if it's something I think that we want to try to become involved with. And it's also, as far as once they get to us, they're in what's called phase three usually. So when drugs are developed, there's different phases of clinical trials. And phase three means they've already gone through two phases of trial to make sure that they're safe, to figure out what the correct dose is, looking at safety in animal models, and then in actual human trials. Trials usually in phase two. And then by the time they get to us, they've been pretty well vetted and there's already research and we already know a bit about the drugs that they're studying.
So what then are you looking for in the clinical trial? It sounds like everything has been already spelled out by the time it hits stage three.
Well, an example is I had a trial that we are thinking about getting into, and what I'm looking at is the drug that's being proposed versus what their placebo arm. Placebo is usually, you know, sort of like a sugar pill or whatever. It's something that's not going to have an effect. But if we have a disease where we have something on the market that we know treats the disease, I need to make sure whatever the placebo is something that is not like worse than standard of care, or if I think that that there's a better option. I'm not going to put a patient into a clinical trial if I think that they're not going to get good enough care if they end up in that placebo arm. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Okay.
Dr. Kelly Beers is our guest today, Medical Director of Albany Medical Center's Glomerular Disease Center. It's nephrology today. I always wondered this about clinical trials. So clinical trials are for people who are not doing that well, right?
Not necessarily. I mean, a lot of clinical trials are really in people who just are in a disease state, but there's a new drug in the market that might make it even better.
Okay, so some people get the placebo, right? That's how these trials work. What if I go in, I'm not feeling well, I got an advanced kidney disease of some kind, and I'm going in for a trial. It's okay then if I don't really get any meds at all, I'm just getting the placebo?
So whenever we're doing these trials, the only way that we can get new drugs into the market is to prove that they're safe and effective. So when these drugs are being developed and we're doing clinical trials, they're comparing it to what we call standard of care. So what are people doing normally now? And so in a placebo arm, you really should be getting the standard of care for your disease state as is currently on the market. And so it's just, if you're if there's a new pill that we think is going to help with chronic kidney disease, you could be getting the new drug, or you could be getting a pill that looks just like the new drug, seems just like the new drug, but is actually not the new drug. It's a placebo. But underneath that, you're still getting whatever is standard of care.
Okay, then how do you know if I'm getting the standard of care and then I enter into this trial and How do you know the trial's doing anything? Because I'm getting the standard of care already.
Right, because both arms, the drug arm and the placebo arm, are getting standard of care. So they match the two groups so that it's basically the same number of men and women in both groups. The ages are pretty similar across the groups. The demographics as far as race are pretty similar across the groups. And then everyone is getting that same standard of care at baseline. But the people getting the research drug are also getting the research drug, and the people that are getting placebo are also getting placebo. And then you look at the outcomes and you say, was the research drug, did they have better results than the standard of care placebo arm? And that's what we tend to see. All the drugs that have come to market over the past few years that we're so excited about in nephrology are drugs that have shown specifically a slower progression of kidney disease or a decrease in protein over time in their urine. And those are kind of the markers that we're using. Some drug trials will do these composite outcomes of kidney failure, meaning ending up on dialysis at the end of the trial or ending up needing a transplant or a change in their GFR, which is how we calculate what kidney function is, or an outcome related to proteinuria. So all of these new drugs, like if you're going to see a kidney doctor, if you're coming to see me and I'm saying we have this new drug and we have shown that it is effective for this disease state because it slows progression of kidney disease, it decreases the protein in the urine, et cetera. That's based on these clinical trials.
We're joined by Dr. Kelly Beers of Albany Med. It's nephrology today. We only have a couple of minutes before the first break, and then we'll hit the phones and the emails. 800-348-2551 is the number, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Quickly take us through the stages of kidney disease. Ultimately, you end up on dialysis. Why do you end up on dialysis? What went wrong?
So many different things can go wrong. As far as the way we stage chronic kidney disease, it's based on your GFR. Anytime you get just standard blood work done, your GFR will be calculated.
GFR being?
GFR is glomerular filtration rate. And so if you look at your blood work, you're going to see something called an eGFR, which is an estimated glomerular filtration rate. That's an estimation of how well your kidneys are cleaning your blood. So we measure something in your blood called creatinine. Creatinine is produced by the body very consistently, and the way the kidneys remove it from the body is also consistent. So if we see the creatinine number going up, it tells us the kidneys aren't cleaning toxins out of the blood as effectively as they should be. And then we use that creatinine value, we put it into an equation that gives us an estimated GFR. And then we stage kidney disease based on that GFR. If you have stable kidney function over 3 months, that is decreased, we say you have chronic kidney disease. So if your GFR is above 60, typically that means your kidney function is normal unless you have something else abnormal, like blood in the urine, protein in the urine, maybe you only have one kidney for some reason. All of those could be reasons that you could have a normal GFR above 60 but still have chronic kidney disease, and that would be stage 1 or 2 chronic kidney disease. Once that GFR falls below 60, now you're in stage 3 chronic kidney disease, which is a GFR between 30 and 60. And then if your GFR is between 15 and 30, that's stage 4. And if it's below 15, that's stage 5 chronic kidney disease.
All right. We only have a minute, and I know this answer will take a long time.
I'll try.
When the kidneys start to fail and they don't filter well enough, what is actually physically going wrong in the kidney that stops it from filtering well?
Well, it depends because there's a lot of different things that can go wrong in the kidneys. But in general, you basically have cell death and cell loss. So the cells that are supposed to be doing the filtering are not working anymore.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Let's grab an email or two before the first break. This one's from Michael in Latham. Gout. Is there any connection between CKD and gout? I have a high uric acid level. And that's from Michael and Latham.
Yeah, so people with chronic kidney disease can definitely develop gout more frequently. There's sort of mixed data on whether it matters that uric acid level is high when you have kidney disease. Some people don't treat just a high uric acid level in chronic kidney disease until you actually get gout. So high uric acid level doesn't mean you have gout. Gout is specifically when you get that really painful joint from the deposition of uric acid crystals in your joint. I have a lot of patients with chronic kidney disease who have chronic gout, and we have them on medications to lower their uric acid level.
Our number is 800-348-2551. Our guest is Dr. Kelly Beers from Albany Med. It's nephrology today. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. One more email for now, and then we'll take a quick break and then hit the phones. This one is from Elizabeth. Can someone have kidney problems without being aware of it? Should seniors get tested?
Yes. So it's actually very common to not know that you have chronic kidney disease. Chronic kidney disease is a very common chronic disease. Unfortunately, 1 in 9 Americans has chronic kidney disease, and the majority don't know that they have it because chronic kidney disease is asymptomatic until you get to really advanced diseases. So everyone should be tested. The recommendations are that all adults are screened once a year, and that should just be in your physical. You should be having a regular basic metabolic panel or comprehensive metabolic panel drawn, and that metabolic panel will give you that GFR number. So if you see on your annual labs with your primary that you have a GFR less than 60, you definitely want to ask that question.
And that's just a urine test?
That's a blood test.
Blood test. All right, let's take a break here. 800-348-2551. If you have a nephrology question for Dr. Kelly Beers, we'll be back. The late, great Sonny Rollins and Night in Tunisia. 800-348-2551 is our number. Ray Graff with you. It's a Medical Monday. Dr. Kelly Beers joins us today. And right before we go to the phones, I just want to pick up on something you said in the break, which just kind of freaks me out. So many people, you said, and I'll paraphrase, you can correct me if I'm wrong, so many people that come to you say, well, I really don't know why I'm here. And then you look at the charts and you say, wow, you've had this chronic kidney disease for years. How can you have it? And your doc, it's one thing if you don't know it. How does your primary not know it?
So I don't know if it's necessarily your primary doesn't know it or if it's just that your primary didn't tell you, because you look at the labs and you can see that the kidney disease, you can see that someone's GFR is less than 60, and that can be happening for many years. There are recommendations as to when you should be referred to a nephrologist, and that's typically if your GFR is depressed for a consistent period of time. If you just have stage 3A kidney disease, your GFR is between 45 and 60, and you don't have any protein in the urine, you don't necessarily need to see a kidney doctor. But it's very important to know that there are medications that you can be on that will slow progression of kidney disease, even when you have that kind of earlier kidney disease, stage 3A. And I don't know if non-nephrologists are as up to date on all of those new medications as a nephrologist is. So I think we're sometimes seeing earlier referrals because some primaries are saying, oh, I see that you have chronic kidney disease, you should see a kidney doctor.
Yeah.
And we do have things that we can do to intervene, which was not always the case. So I think it's sort of educating primary care providers that there are a lot of interventions that we can do earlier that will slow progression of kidney disease and potentially save some people from ending up on dialysis.
Why is it a big deal if you're leaking protein?
So if you're leaking protein, it means that the filter part of the kidneys is damaged because the holes in the filter should be small enough that protein doesn't get through. Protein's a bigger molecule. So if you see the protein, you know that the holes have become stretched out, have gotten bigger, the filter is damaged in some way.
So that's just a symptom of damaged kidneys and not in itself a problem.
It is a problem in itself. So if you have proteinuria with a normal GFR, that's actually still chronic kidney disease. And there's a reason that there was a damage to the filter. And proteinuria, if you have more proteinuria, that's going to lead to faster decline in your kidney function. So a lot of what we target is things to reduce protein in the urine because we know it'll slow the progression of kidney disease. And with the glomerular disease, the glomerulus is the filter. So the glomerular disease clinic, we are targeting diseases that are specifically attacking the filter part of the kidney. A lot of those are autoimmune diseases. So if I get a patient who has normal kidney function but a lot of protein in the urine, I'm concerned there's some kind of a disease where the body is attacking that filter, and there's things I can do to stop that from happening.
And how do you diagnose what disease it is?
From a biopsy.
Right.
Yeah. So we do a kidney biopsy. We send it to a pathologist. The pathologist looks at that and is able to tell from looking at the filter exactly what's going on.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. It's Nephrology Today with Dr. Kelly Beers from Albany Med. Let's go to Great Barrington. Terry, you're on. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a son who's 19 years old. He has Down syndrome and suffers with chronic kidney disease. He's been on the cusp of stage 3A, and the doctor that we've been seeing started him on Farxiga, and then more recently, because of his lab results, has started him on a phosphate binder. And I guess my question to you is, I'm trying to figure out what my next step would be. You know, should I be heading to Boston? You know, where should I be going to, I guess, find out if he's eligible for any clinical trials? You know, we're at a point now where, you know, it seems like a foregone conclusion. He's going to end up on dialysis and need a transplant. And, you know, I'd like to see what else is out there before we get to that point.
Yeah, so I have a few patients with Downs. There's not necessarily like a specific kidney disease that we would expect in people with Down syndrome. There's a lot of different manifestations that we can see. And obviously, I don't know your son, so I don't know his exact chronic kidney disease and what the etiology is that caused it. So I would definitely talk with his doctor about what exactly is his disease. And you can always, you know, get a second opinion at an academic center. And then, you know, dapagliflozin, which is Farxiga, is an SGLT2 inhibitor. That's one of those classes of medications that I was saying are newer, and we know slow progression of kidney disease. So it's great that he's on that. And there might be some other things out there that could help him as well.
Okay. Is it rare for somebody this age to be this advanced?
Well, you said he's
kidney disease
3A.
Yeah.
Yeah, so 3A is pretty much the earliest stage that we diagnose if there's not something else going on, like blood or protein in the urine. So that's that GFR of 45 to 60. If his urine is normal and his GFR is above 60, then by definition, he actually doesn't have chronic kidney disease. So it sounds like he's probably in the earlier stages of chronic kidney disease. There's also something that we can check in addition to creatinine called cystatin C, which can be a more accurate way of assessing what the overall kidney function is. If you do a combination of creatinine and cystatin C calculation for GFR, it's a little bit more accurate. But if he's staying in stage 3A, that's a good place to be.
All right, Terry.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. What does creatinine actually do? What good things does it do?
So it's in our muscles. It's part of muscle. And it's just because of the way our muscles are constantly rebuilding, breaking down, creatinine gets released into the bloodstream.
And so why is it bad that it's not filtered out by the kidneys?
It's not that the creatinine itself is bad. It's just we use it as a marker of kidney function. So it's something because of the way the kidneys handle it, it's predictable. There's other things that we can measure that aren't as predictable about how the kidneys are going to get rid of it. It's just what we've used as a marker kind of forever. But cystatin C is another newer marker that we use for the same thing.
How long has the glomerular center been open at Albany Med?
About a year.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, now that you're a year in and things are a well-oiled machine, where are you going with this? What's next on your horizon?
So one thing that's awesome about our GN Center, which is unique, is that we actually have embedded pharmacists. So when patients come and see us at the GN Center, they're going to be seeing either myself or my colleague, Dr. Mehta, and then they're also going to be seeing a pharmacist at the same time, which is great. They really are able to offer a lot for the patients to give them more information about the drugs that they're getting and kind of answer a lot of questions. And then we also have really good relationships with other areas that are involved in these diseases, like rheumatology, pulmonology, hematology. We have these resources right at our fingertips that we can talk to the same providers. And then if there is something where we think the patient's going to need a newer medication, there's a bunch of new drugs that have just come onto the market that we're able to get patients pretty quickly because of the relationships that we have. Also, we have the knowledge to get those drugs to the patients when they need them. And then, like I said, down the line, we should be able to access clinical trials for patients.
Remind me, if we have time, to talk about some of these new drugs. You don't have to say them by name, but some of the things that they do.
Yeah.
Let's go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Annie, you're on.
Hey, how are you guys? Thank you for calling.
Welcome.
My question has to do with protein. You mentioned that if the filter is damaged in your kidney, that you will lose protein. And I'm wondering if you're witnessing that when you urinate in the morning and see some foamy bubbles in your urine, if that's the protein.
It definitely could be. So protein in the urine in the toilet will look like foam that just kind of sits on top. And unlike bubbles from just kind of like churning up the water, they won't go away. They'll stay kind of floating around on top of the toilet bowl. And that definitely could be a sign of protein. And so if you're having that consistently, I would definitely ask your doctor to check your urine and specifically measure how much protein is in the urine.
When I had my recent protein test, everything was fine. I mean, my kidney test. But I'm wondering, is there something that you're eating or drinking that's causing that filter to leak?
No. So people ask me all the time, is the protein in my urine from the protein that I'm eating? And it's completely unrelated. It's just those holes becoming damaged from the cells at the filter level becoming damaged.
All right, Annie.
And that could also be age. I'm 85.
So our kidneys do age. We do expect your GFR to go down a little bit every year by about one, but that should not put protein in your urine. So if you do have protein in the urine, that's never normal.
All right, Annie, thanks a lot for the call. But okay, I'm sorry. I say this often on this show about different illnesses. If you get to 85 and you're still walking around and maybe you got some bubbles when you pee, is it the end of the world? How much longer are you going to live?
It's just important to know how much protein there is, because I've had people get really sick with a ton of protein. If you're spilling a ton of protein, that's going to lead to your entire body blowing up, actually. So when you're losing protein in the urine at a significant rate, the protein that's supposed to be in our blood vessels helps to keep fluid inside of our blood vessels. So once you lose that protein in the urine, now there's nothing keeping fluid inside your blood vessels and it leaks out.
And you bloat out?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So I have some older patients who are just, they get so, so swollen because of losing all that protein. And that's not good.
No, that is terrible. All right. The number, I take it back. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Dr. Kelly Beers, nephrology today on the program. Let's do a couple emails. This one's from Bill in Lake George. I'm 76. For years, had a sodium level 131 to 136. I take losartan and amlodipine. Does this chronic condition cause increased morbidity and mortality? And that's from Bill in Lake George. You like the way I say the drug.
No,
name,
you
don't
did
you?
Really well.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. All right. So what do you think about Bill's question?
So, yeah, low sodium levels, the medical term for that is hyponatremia. And yes, having chronic hyponatremia is associated with morbidity and mortality. That being said, I don't get that upset about a sodium that's consistently in the 130s. I think if you're 131 to 135, you're probably fine. I think if you're in the high 120s more regularly, that would probably be more of a problem. And it would kind of all depend on what is causing you to be hyponatremic as to how you would fix it. But if you're always in the 130s, I wouldn't worry too much about it.
So you said that the protein that might show up on your GFR, right? The GFR, is that what we're talking about? The testing that you do, the blood testing.
Yes.
That has nothing to do with your protein intake, right?
Well, your GFR can be affected by your protein intake, because if you have a really, really high protein diet, that's going to cause you to probably have a higher creatinine level.
But does sodium, if I eat a ton of sodium, if I go home and have a pound of salt every day.
Mm-hmm. Great question. So the sodium levels in your blood are actually a reflection of how much water you have in your blood.
Oh.
Which is something a lot of people don't understand. So when you have low sodium levels in your blood, it actually means you have more water in relationship to salt. So that could mean that you have too much sodium and too much water. It could mean you have not enough sodium and not enough water, but more water than sodium. Or it could mean you have the right amount of sodium, but too much water.
Unbelievable.
But it's all about water.
Okay. Hydration. It's always talk hydration. You drink as much water as you can. Too much of a good thing is a bad thing, right?
Yes, you can drink too much. That's for sure. There is a really interesting entity called psychogenic polydipsia, meaning that you just drink gallons and gallons and gallons of water, and you can actually drive down your sodium levels to really dangerous places if you drink gallons and gallons of water a day. I've seen it. It's wild. And then also there's some people who really need to restrict the amount of fluid that they take in because they might have heart disease, or they might be spilling too much protein in the urine, and then it might, you know, go into the rest of their body. People that have cirrhosis need to watch how much fluid they're taking in.
So when you're at the glomerular disease center, are you in fact, yes, you diagnose, you treat, but are you managing patients' sort of life outside of the medical world.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time talking to people about their diet, about avoiding sodium, about how much protein they should be eating. We refer to a renal dietitian very regularly to talk about the best renal diet. I like to always tell people to go to the National Kidney Foundation's website, which is kidney.org. They have a ton of great resources there, including a lot of diet stuff. People have so many questions about what is a kidney-friendly diet. A lot of it depends on what your stage of kidney disease is, what caused your kidney disease, et cetera. But overall, in general, for most people, low sodium is super important because too much salt is going to be hard for your kidneys. And ideally, you probably are eating more of a vegetable diet than an animal-based diet. When it comes to protein, protein is very hot right now. Not necessarily amazing for your kidneys. And there is some data, especially in the United Kingdom, showing that people that have a vegetarian diet get more of their protein from plants, are less likely to develop chronic kidney disease. And if they have kidney disease, it's less likely to worsen.
So interesting. Dr. Kelly Beers joins us today. The number is 800-348-2551. And this question, Paul wrote in from Albany, vegan diet, is it best for kidney health? Well, we just discussed that, but can a vegan diet be bad for kidney health?
It depends on if you already have kidney disease. It depends on if you have chronic kidney disease and you really need to watch your potassium levels, for example. A vegan diet is probably going to be higher in the potassium. That could be tough. And you need to always, you still need protein, right? You need to make sure you're getting protein. And so that's the thing I always say to my vegetarians and vegans, is just make sure you're getting some good plant-based protein.
The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Kelly Beers joins us from Albany Med, nephrology today. Now listen, don't get too excited. We've had one call from Matamoros already. I think we're going to double up. Jim, go ahead.
How common is leptospirosis and the cause of kidney disease?
Leptospirosis. How common is it as a cause of kidney disease? I would say not very.
What is leptospirosis?
Leptospirosis is a very specific...
is that a cat thing?
I think it's a bacteria. Is it bacteria? Leptospirosis. I haven't thought about that in a long time. You're going to stumble me, but I'm going to get it for you.
Jim, how did you come up with this question, man?
Well, being a veterinarian, dogs are vaccinated for it, and it's common in rat urine.
Aha. All right. I'm sorry I asked. Doctor, what do you think?
Yeah, so it's a spirochete. It is a type of bacteria. But it's definitely not a common cause of kidney disease. And if it is causing kidney disease, it's probably just because people are getting sick. If people get leptospirosis and get sick from leptospirosis, they could have kidney disease as a consequence of just
okay.
getting sick.
Jim, thanks a lot. We'll take a break here. 800-348-2551 is the number. If you have a kidney question for Dr. Kelly Beers, director of Albany Med's Glomerular Disease Center, 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Dizzy Gillespie, Lalo Schifrin and company there on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Riggraff with you. It's Medical Monday, nephrology today with Dr. Kelly Beers from Albany Med. And briefly, before we get to the email bag again, you mentioned some of these new drugs. What do they do that is better than the old drugs?
Some of the most exciting new drugs are in the field of glomerular disease, and they're specifically targeting something called IgA nephropathy, although I think a lot of them are going to expand and treat probably other autoimmune diseases and other GNs. There's a whole new class of medications called APRIL and BAFF inhibitors that I'm very excited about. And these are something that are specifically targeting B cell maturation. How much in the weeds do you want me to get on this? Because I am excited.
How about 28 seconds of weeds? Go ahead.
Basically, the B cells are the part of the immune system that make antibodies against different things in our body. And so with autoimmune disease, a lot of what's happening is that our bodies are making antibodies against things it shouldn't be making antibodies against. So there's this new class of medications that are targeting basically different molecules that help tell the B cells to mature into the cells that are going to make those antibodies. And so they're blocking that from happening. So we're really targeting the early level of the immune system to target the cells that are making the antibodies that are causing all the problems.
Okay. I hope there's not a test on this. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Kelly Beers is with us. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Deb writes in, what does it mean when your first urine of the day is very dark? Throughout the day, the urine has sediment. And that's from Deb.
So It could mean so many different things. I mean, it depends on, is your urine dark just because it's concentrated? Does it have blood in it? If you've got sediment in your urine, it could be that there's some kind of blood. Maybe you have stones or something. Like, you really need, if you're consistently seeing what seems abnormal as far as your urine, you should probably ask your doctor to get a urinalysis for you.
Number's 800-348-2551. Dr. Kelly Beers is here, and let's go to Kingston. Anne Marie, you're on.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a question. I was diagnosed with a nephrotic syndrome when I was like 16 years old. I had it until I was about 19. I had like relapses, was on high doses of prednisone, was cured, technically, I guess. Went to my OBGYN and got tested before I had a baby. He said I was fine. My everything looked good. So I'm just wondering now, two things. I was told originally never give blood, that it would, I guess, hurt my kidneys or something. And what do I have to look to in my aging years?
Okay.
Is this going to be an issue?
That's a great question.
I'm 58 now. Sorry.
Oh, you're 58. Wow. Okay, great. So if you haven't had any relapses really as an adult, then it's probably unlikely that you will. Nephrotic syndrome in children is interesting. I'm not a pediatric nephrologist, so I'm going to just say that to begin with, but I'm a glomerular disease expert, so I know some things about nephrotic syndrome in kids. The way we treat nephrotic syndrome in kids is different than what we do in adults. Like, in kids, they never do biopsies, really. They basically just give prednisone, and usually people get better. And oftentimes, it doesn't come back as an adult. It's something you almost grow out of. If you develop swelling, I would definitely make sure your primary is checking your urine once a year just to make sure there's no protein in the urine, because that could be, you know, a sign that something's coming back. You want to be checking your GFR annually to make sure that your kidney function is still normal. But I would say if you've gone this far and you haven't had any recurrence, you're probably not going to have any.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Now, you said pediatric nephrologists generally don't give biopsies. What other differences are there between pediatric and adult nephrology?
Well, they take care of kids, right? And kids are not just tiny adults. They're aliens. I don't know. Like, they're so
Wait a
different.
Minute, you have kids. What are you talking about?
I know. And my kids are aliens. Right, I tell my
fine.
Pediatrician all the time. I don't know what she does.
Okay.
So it's just a very different thing. So they deal with a lot of congenital kidney disease that I don't even really understand. We have a wonderful pediatric nephrologist at Albany Med who tends to send me his patients when they age out. And so then I have to learn about all these things that that these kids have had. Lots of interesting congenital diseases that they have. But then there's also a lot of kids that have, you know, things that happen and then they get better and they never have kidney disease again. So it's very different.
All right. One more email here and then we'll go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Jody writes in, can you recommend a specific kidney cleanse or is this something that doesn't really work? I've been on line a few times. I always wondered if it's actually effective.
No, it doesn't work.
No?
No.
I mean, what does it purport to do?
I have no idea. They're all different. I've seen lots of different things, but most of those things online they're just trying to get your money from you. So
okay.
I definitely wouldn't. Your kidneys don't really need to be cleansed. Just make sure you're keeping them hydrated.
All right. Number here is 800-348-2551. It's Dr. Kelly Beers from Albany Med. Miles is in Queensbury. Miles, go ahead.
Good afternoon and hello.
Hello.
Last year I had an episode of acute kidney failure, and I was on dialysis for a few months, and I was able to recover pretty much. But I have a couple of lingering things, and I don't know if they're related to the kidney problems or to the treatment or what it was. And they are specifically edema in my lower legs and a very low hemoglobin count. And I was on prednisone and other things, including some fairly exotic stuff for quite a while. And I'm wondering if where to look for treating those things, if you have any suggestions.
Are you still seeing a nephrologist, Miles?
Sort of. I mean, I once every couple of months I check in, but I'm, my creatinine levels are down and I'm pretty much, I think, over the kidney episode.
Great. Well, congratulations. That's good. So when you have chronic kidney disease, it can contribute to anemia. If your kidney function has completely recovered and you're still anemic, then I would definitely say they should probably try to figure out why you're still anemic if your kidneys are working normally. And then as far as the edema, yeah, I mean, that definitely could be related to your kidneys. But if your kidney functions back to normal and you don't have protein in the urine, then the edema should not be related. I mean, you could have like chronic injury to your blood vessels in your legs, which would cause you to have chronic edema. There's various medications that can cause lower extremity edema. So I would definitely, if you're still seeing a nephrologist, I would definitely ask them about those things. And you're up in Queensbury, so I feel like there's only a couple options of who you could be seeing, and I probably know them.
Well, no names, please.
Well, no name. Well, except one name, maybe, which is that I would like to shout out to your associate, Dr. Mehta, who was the one who figured out what was wrong with me and designed a.
I don't know. Is that fair, judges? Can we allow
yes,
that?
Yes, we. Okay. I allow it because I love Dr. Mehta. She is the co-director of the GN clinic, and she's fantastic.
Okay. Well, thank you, Miles.
Yeah. So.
Anything else besides platitudes? Are you done?
No, I'm done.
Hey, man, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Dr. Kelly Beers today from Albany Medical Center's Glomerular Disease Center. I said it so poorly years ago when she was on that now that I can say it, I try to say it as much as I can. All right, let's see now. Jim Mountier, we ready over there? Colette, another Queensbury. Hello, Colette in Queensbury. You're on.
Hi, yes. I'm specifically interested in knowing about this medication or this application that you're talking about in regards to an autoinflammatory disorder called hidradenitis suppurativa, sometimes called HS. It's gotten a lot more recognition recently, but there's still a lot of unknowns.
Yeah, so I do not know that much about the disease. I have patients, obviously, that have it, and I've seen it, but I don't personally treat it. So I would say I can't answer that question. I'm not qualified. I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. I was just interested in the fact that you said it was helping situations where your body is attacking certain things, and HS is basically your body's attacking the hair follicles.
Yeah.
Do you think that that would be a similar thing that it has had success with?
I have no idea. I don't know if it's been studied in HS specifically.
Well,
I'm sorry.
I appreciate your time, and I'll keep searching.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Colette, thanks a lot for the call. Erica writes in, my 14-year-old son's morning breath sometimes smells like urine. Could this indicate a kidney problem? Should I get testing done?
I'm so sorry to hear that. I mean, yes. You should probably definitely bring that up to the pediatrician.
Do you think that that's a thing? Here's the thing. I had a cat years ago, lived to 18. I know that you don't do cats.
I don't do cats.
Okay,
no.
Fine. But 18, the cat lived to 18. This is decades ago. And at the end of the kitty's life, breath would smell like urine and the kidneys ended up failing. So
yeah, so it actually, it's, you know, I'm laughing, but there are, you know, back in the day, nephrologists used to, or doctors used to diagnose diabetes by drinking urine. And if it tasted sweet, they had diabetes.
What?
Like there's a lot. Yeah, we don't do that anymore. But no, people can have like weird odors that actually can indicate disease. So I would definitely bring up, you know, weird breath odor to the pediatrician.
But that's not one you hear very often.
No.
But I mean, okay. Well, that's an interesting answer. Our guest today is Dr. Kelly Beers from Albany Med's Glomerular Disease Center. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dennis writes in, as a 73-year-old male, can you tell me what foods or beverages to avoid to protect my kidneys?
Just low-sodium diet. Don't get dehydrated.
Yeah. Is there a lot of water and beer and stuff? I mean,
well, the thing about alcohol is it's actually dehydrating. People don't realize that. So alcohol is a diuretic. Alcohol and caffeine both do not count. They're not going to hydrate you. If you're drinking nothing but like coffee and soda, all you're doing is drinking diuretics. You're peeing out more than you're taking in.
Okay, let's go back to the phones and we'll go to New Paltz. Elizabeth, you're on with Dr. Kelly Beers.
Hi. I wanted to know what the difference is between a nephrologist and a urologist.
Okay.
And if somebody had acute kidney failure and had surgery for it 10 years ago and has recently had radiation treatment for prostate cancer, when is it appropriate to consult the nephrologist in addition to the urologist? Because I'm not sure everything is being taken care of.
Elizabeth, I'm assuming you're not the one who had the prostate cancer?
correct.
Okay.
So that's a, I like this question a lot because we get this all the time. So a urologist is a surgeon and a nephrologist is a medical doctor. So the urologists are the surgeons that specialize in all things kidney, ureter, bladder, urethra. And then nephrologists are the doctors who take care of the actual function of the kidneys. So I share a lot of patients with my urology colleagues. If you have had surgery in the past because of, you know, people that lost a kidney, had to have a kidney removed, prostate surgery that led to long-term kidney damage potentially, all of those reasons would, you know, if you have a decrease in the function of the kidney, that's when you see a nephrologist. If you have something that requires surgery, that's when you see a urologist.
Aha. Elizabeth, does that work for you?
Well, now he has after effects of cyberknife. And he's having symptoms as a result.
Yeah, if it's symptoms that have...
appropriate to see a nephrologist?
He would be needing to see a nephrologist if the issue is with the function of the kidneys and how well the kidneys are cleaning the blood. If it's just that he's having issues with incontinence or urinary frequency or something like that, that would be urology.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot for the call. Gladys in the 518 writes, can you talk about familial hematuria? If repeat urine screens are positive for hematuria, but ultrasound is negative, is it necessary to see a nephrologist? Don't have any idea of what I just read. Maybe you can give me some definitions.
Okay, so she's asking about blood in the urine. Familial hematuria is when people, there's some families where everyone has blood in their urine, just microscopic blood. You don't see it with the naked eye, but you see it when you have a urine test done. Now, there's various things that can cause you to always have blood in the urine. One of those is something called Alport's, which is a congenital inherited disease that can also affect your vision and your hearing. So definitely something to actually get diagnosed if you have Alport's. There's also something called thin basement membrane disease, which basically doesn't do anything other than you have blood in your urine and it doesn't hurt your kidney function at all. And then there's also this IgA nephropathy that I mentioned earlier. You can have intermittently having blood in your urine plus or minus protein in the urine. So it's good if you have familial hematuria, you always have blood in the urine, everyone has it. I would recommend definitely having a urinalysis to make sure that there's no protein. Keep an eye on that. Make sure that there's no protein because the protein is a thing that's bad. It wouldn't be a bad idea to just see a nephrologist once just to kind of rule out other things that could be going on. Some people do a biopsy in the case of hematuria just to confirm what the diagnosis is. We've sort of changed as a nephrology community. We're a little bit more aggressive about who we biopsy because of the new treatments that we have to treat various things. And we want to just make sure we're not missing something that could potentially get worse.
Are biopsies painful? Kidney biopsies?
It's not really painful. At Albany Med, our interventional radiologists do them, and they actually give people a little bit of light sedation so they don't really feel it. I used to do them myself when I was in fellowship. I would do the biopsies, and I always told people it was worse to go to the dentist. It's a big needle, but we numb the area and just take a couple samples, and you might be a little sore, but it's not too bad.
Dr. Kelly Beers joins us today, medical director of Albany Med's Glomerular Disease Center. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Joyce is in Brattleboro. Hello, Joyce. How are you?
Hi. My question is, somebody told me that diagnostic imaging contrast could be bad for the kidneys.
Yes.
Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so contrast that you get with a CAT scan or if you're having like a cardiology procedure where they inject contrast to look at what they're doing, that type of contrast can be bad for the kidneys in people who already have kidney disease. Typically, if your kidney function is normal and you're well hydrated and you're not taking certain medications, contrast should be fine. But once you have kidney disease, it can become a problem. It's a little bit controversial. I think most nephrologists feel strongly that we want to avoid contrast because we don't want our patient's kidney function to get worse. There's some data that shows that even if the function gets worse, it kind of goes back to normal. I usually tell people to avoid it as much as they can. But if your kidney function is normal, you should be okay.
Go ahead, Joyce.
Okay. Can you comment about, I've heard about gadolinium being really bad.
So gadolinium is the contrast we use for MRIs, and that actually does not hurt the kidneys. The earlier generations of gadolinium, first generation gadolinium, could cause this very bad thing called NSF. The newer generations of gadolinium, which is what everyone uses now, have never done that. There's been zero cases in the second and third generation of gadolinium, which is what most places are using now. But that is only causing a problem in people whose kidney function is very limited. So someone whose GFR is like less than 20.
All right, Joyce, thanks for the call. Let's go to Albany and Veronica. Veronica, you're on.
Thank you. My doctor told me I had crystals and asked me if I was urinating a lot and told me to cut down on greens. So can you tell me something about that? Thank you.
All right. Crystals, I think Veronica said.
Yeah, crystals. There's different types of crystals that you can see in the urine. So it would kind of depend on what crystals they were. And they can be caused by different things. Some can cause more damage than others. So it would depend on what the crystals were.
I like this business about cutting down on greens, though. Veronica, thanks a lot. So don't eat as many vegetables is what you're saying, Doc?
No.
You sure?
Eat your vegetables.
All right. Let's go to Annie, who's on I-90, heading to beloved Maine. Annie, go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi.
So I was kind of interested when I heard you talking about kidney disease. My case is kind of stumped the doctors. A few years ago, got sick and lost a lot of weight over the course of a month. Nothing was ever determined, but after that, I was found to have hematuria, and my EGFR is 48. I'm 68 years old. I weigh about 110 pounds, and I don't have any other symptoms, and those numbers are all stable, but I always have blood in the urine. And I always have the EGFR is about 47, 48, and it's not changing. And so I did see a urologist, and a nephrologist, and he indicated that because it's not changing over time, there's really nothing that I need to be worried about.
Yeah, I mean, I can't, without, you know, seeing everything in your chart and seeing you and everything, I can't say. If you're stable, that's great. I'm glad you saw a nephrologist. And
all right. Good? Good. All right. Very quickly, we only have about 30 seconds here with Dr. Kelly Beers. These hours go very quickly. Let's go to Connecticut. Ronnie, you got to make it quick, okay?
Okay. If you're missing your spleen and one adrenal gland, does it have any effect on the kidneys?
It shouldn't, assuming they left your kidney when they took the adrenal gland.
So no effect at all.
Should be fine, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Well, you have time for one more. Ken in Pine Plains, super quick, buddy.
Okay, I've had kidney stones twice and passed them, and now I'm told that it's too large to pass, but it's been about 5 years. What's your verdict about can I live with a large kidney stone?
You can. You just need to make sure that it doesn't cause obstruction to the point that you're not able to get urine out of that kidney, because if you have a chronically obstructed kidney, then the kidney itself will die off.
All right, Ken, we got to leave it there. Dr. Kelly Beers, A1, thank you for being here. We'll see you next year, perhaps. Support comes from Beacon Fine Art Printing. Beacon, offering museum-quality digital archival printing, scanning, retouching, mounting, and framing for artists, photographers, galleries, and art enthusiasts. BeaconFineArtPrinting.com. Thanks again to Dr. Kelly Beers of Albany Med for being here. Thank you for listening. We got to all the calls today. Remarkably, that's because she's so ruthlessly efficient. Thanks to Mike Bowen, our engineer. Jim Mountier screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's weather with Spectrum One meteorologist Ryan Finn. We'll see you tomorrow at 2.